course.
But I think I can see that the body is changing. I mean, certainly you remember when he was a little baby. Certainly he's changed. Okay, and so one moment's going after another. But I always thought that there's some final changes of this present body.
You're asking me how I can try to see
what you're doing. Yeah. But might there not be an, a visible end to this body? And so, then, how do you go from moment to moment after that? Now you really got me mystified. And so, you're the first one I met who's admitted it that quickly. You come to the right place. So, spiritually, you go on and on. Yeah. It seems that we have to try to understand more what that means. And that might mean we have to get some clear and almost final answers. Probably what? Anyone else? So just find some. What do you think? Everything. So how do you live your life in terms of that principle?
Reaction from the prison, the reflection of all the experiences that have brought up their
And how do you figure out what's right for yourself? That's the final answer. No final answer, you say. So I asked if that's the final answer. So that's all you do? Can we give the lady a seat? Is that all you do? Deep thought and comas and discussion? I mean, is that your whole day? What are you mainly doing during the day? How do you do that? So the whole day you spend not getting in people's way. That's your prime occupation?
Thinking, hopefully,
thinking about what the other person is feeling.
So you don't do anything else besides this? That's all you do all day long. Oh, what was that last thing? Oh. So there is, you have some final things you have to do, right? But how many days of the week do you go to work? So every day has a different question, but 5 of those days, the activity is the same. You see my point? Every day, does anyone catch that point here? Every day, he's saying he has a different question. But I'm pointing out that 5 or 7 days, he's doing the same thing. So maybe things aren't so different. What would you say as an experienced man in the field?
Well,
that's clear. How would we get more information about this higher power, those of us who would be interested in that kind of thing? Wouldn't that be a good question?
For me,
it comes from the business. It's not a spiritual question. Oh, now you're mystifying me just like he did. You're losing me. Stop using those big words.
I have no explanation. I think in the accident, accepting and doing that certain gifts to me is excellent for me.
Something that has no explanation for anyone who does not partake of it. Anyone else? Any other comments? Have you any? Yeah?
I think that the logical take is on the right perception of what you can take to do. And then you're more intuitive to locate within a moment, or no higher authority.
I wonder when. I'm sure some of you have computers at home, some of you have some kind of appliances, yes, even a stereo, yes, or something, right? You must have something, right? Everybody here's got something, yes? In your car, you got something? Got one of those big systems in your car?
I didn't.
But you got something, right?
Yeah.
So doesn't everything come with an instruction manual? Now, do you say, well, there's no clear and final ways to deal with this new gadget I have? We can discuss it, think about it, and be silent, and let the wonder fill each moment. Is that the way you approach your new device, your new computer, or your new stereo system? Does anybody do that? And after you get confused, then what do you do? You read the manual after a while. Not at first. After a while, you read the manual. Why do you do that? Because you're afraid of destroying your machine, right? But one thing we might notice is interesting. We as individuals don't have any fear about possibly destroying our lives. You know, it's like kind of this, you just take it as it comes. I notice that people don't have a real driving determination to find some set principles and set standards. Now suppose those of you who work, or even those of you who go to the university or school, suppose your employer or your teacher treated you in this way. When it comes time for your paycheck, he says, "There's no clearing by the letters." There's going to be discussion and thoughts and silent wonder filling each moment. What would you say? Huh? Do you have any employers here? Everybody knows it's like to work, so suppose that when it's time to get your check, that's the answer you get. Will anyone here be satisfied? Or anyone going to the uni here? Or going to school? So suppose your teacher, you know, when it comes time for you to get your grade, the teacher just tells you, you know, he's not going to give you your diploma or your certificate or whatever because there's no clear and final answers.
Well, it'd be quite
emphasis, really.
Yeah? It'd be quite emphasis, appropriate, because that's what it comes down to.
Oh, but yeah, I see what you mean. Of course, I remember when I was in university, that was during the countercultural years, and this students were always on the lookout for courses where a teacher was really trying to be different and radical, and he would let you make up your own grade. So, I took one philosophy course about higher consciousness. So, you know, the teacher said, "Okay, now you all just give yourself a grade according to, you know, where you think you're at." Well, of course, I said, I deserve honors. No doubt about it. Clear, definite. So, my point is, can't we see that although we may be mentally attracted to this notion, when it actually comes to living, we want clear, definite things? How many of you in here have girlfriends or boyfriends? Anyone? No one. Okay, in any case, let's pretend you did. Well, crowd is definitely different. So, suppose, you know, you're trying to make some definite progress with your girlfriend or boyfriend, and whenever you ask a question, you always get the answer, you know, there's nothing clear and final. You'd get quite frustrated after a while, wouldn't you? Because relationships are about building up some kind of definite guidelines and procedures. So once again we see that although we say these kind of things, we don't act that way. Suppose the government of New Zealand began to treat you all like this. I knew someone was going to say that. When it actually comes down to getting served, things like that, from the government, getting protection from the government, suppose that was completely the answer, 100%. You'd say, what's the use in paying our rates, right? What are we getting in return? Of course, you're saying that now, but at least you feel you're getting a little something. Suppose every time you went to the social benefits office, or you went, whatever, and all you were told is there's no clear and final answer. It's just the wonder that fills every moment. So my point is, it's quite obvious that we live our life in a very definite way. Now, why is it when it comes to deciding what we should do and what the standards are, then everything becomes indefinite? Why is that?
I think what leads on to this is that, yes, that's a good thing, pretty accurate, or sort of that thing. But of course, the great leap forward that people are in error about is to what? And they do not want to be sucked in by dogma. Because there's lots of dogma out there which will fill all that up.
Okay, the D word. Very popular these days.
Well, I mean dogma, I mean whether it's philosophical, religious, political, or whatever. People want structures. They're also very, very important. Is it embracing a lot of things? Because it's a very good cynicism.
I see them embracing a lot of things.
Well, they do, yeah. I need to embrace other things in another 6 months' time. And the level of the stupidity of the sort of people is often closely accompanied by the fact that how often they change their mind.
So, now this word dogma, everyone has used that word. Have you used that word before?
Yeah.
Yeah. You've used that word?
Well,
what does it mean to you? Well, just take a stab at it. Yeah. Not an English test. What would you say? What would you say it means?
It means set of words defining a ballistic.
Okay. And you? A belief system. Now, what are your feelings about Bhagavad Gita? So, any of you a little bit familiar with Bhagavad Gita?
Well, the phrase I always come back to with this discussion is religion without philosophy is dogma. Philosophy without religion is speculation.
Can you expound upon that, please?
Well, it's not there in a nutshell, but I can repeat it.
Sorry. Did everyone catch what Grant said here?
I suppose if I could expound on the expanding. I mean, what the trap that you can fall into, I think, is that sort of you take on board a dogma, a religion, or whatever, and you've got a set of rules, and you sort of close yourself off, blinking yourself off, and rigorously follow those things. And that just becomes dogma. Without any real intelligence. But if you put philosophy, what you can understand the rigors of, then you argue, then counter-argue, whatever. You start to get something. But if you just take philosophy by itself, without the underpinning of the religion and the ritual and what you call it, without that, well, you often end up with speculation. And not everybody out there speculates about money, because they don't really know, because they don't know anything, so like the Gita, they don't really know anything about the Bible. So it's all speculation. But without any real grounding through the great ancient texts, for instance, so it's become a speculation. So I always think if you've got to have religion and philosophy coming together. Can't just have one or the other. I mean, it's a very rough way of putting it, but it starts to be
Yeah. Sorry, David, we don't like to get off the
track. Yes, you are. Down in New York, we saved your enemy. You know, because when the payphone used to cost a dime, we say, you're dying. No, it's your class. So, anyone notice how people, if you go out, if you just walk down the stairs to Broadway and look up and down the street tonight on a Friday night, my point is you're going to see a lot of dogma out there, just like you were saying. What are you actually going to see? You're going to see people with their blinders on who have beliefs that the goal of life is to satisfy the body and to relieve the aching of the mind, and they don't want to think about anything more than that. They want to be entertained, they want to be stimulated, that's it. If that can happen, they consider it a great Friday night. Now, isn't that dogma? What do you think? You've got certain beliefs.
Yes. The dogma of material.
You have certain beliefs. I am this body. I want to enjoy. And enjoying means I need some good sensations for my skin and some entertainment for my mind. If that happens, great. I'm focused on that. You notice if you go out there, the people are completely focused. They're going towards McDonald's or KFC or the cinema. You know, they're concentrated, and they have beliefs. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah.
Hmm? You use that. What does that mean now, materialistic? Shallow, you say that's shallow. Now what's deep? You gotta get off the hook pretty easily. Okay. So what I'd like us to meditate on is that, please remember, while saying that there's no clear and final answer, so on and so forth, we live our life in a very clear and final way. We've got things to do, goals to achieve, places to go, people to meet, right? Isn't that definite? Isn't that clear? And the reasons behind all that, those form our dogma, our belief system, right? Everybody agrees with that? Or no? You've gotten around that one yet? No. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It would seem that if we're going to take up a spiritual pursuit, we just can't believe. We have to have a system of verifying, of experiencing. That, to me, separates the blind following from the actual rare calling. If you can actually get a chance to verify, to experience, then you're into something. I've said it before, I don't know if I've said it here, but in the Bhagavad Gita, nowhere will you find Krishna saying, just believe in me. You'll never find one verse like that, just believe. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains spiritual science and always gives you procedures to verify and experience what is being said. In other words, first you hear, and then you apply your senses according to what you hear, and you get the experience. Now, isn't that fair enough? You tell me. What more would you like to see? Does that sound fair enough to you? whole point of Bhagavad Gita is simply to get you to hear and then apply your senses. In other words, change your lifestyle so that you will get the result. It's not a theoretical thing. There has to be some change in the way you use your mind and your senses. You have to learn how to interact with this world in a different way. Now, who here would ever consider such a thing? Would you consider changing your way of, your patterns of interaction? Would you consider? So, our point in our Bhagavad Gita workshops is that if we can just recognize the value of what's being said in Bhagavad Gita and put it into our own laboratory, then Krishna assures you you're going to get the results. But never you read a text, a verse where Krishna says, just believe. No, Bhagavad Gita is an action book. That's why it's spoken on a battlefield. You can't think of a more active place than a battlefield. Not a theoretical place, a place for theorizing. So, if we put into action what we're hearing, then we get the result that's described. So, Grant, would you agree that that's different from what dogma is? Now, whether we want to put into action what Krishna says, well, that's up to each person. At the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, I've explained everything to you, deliberate on it fully, and then do what you wish to do. But then Krishna points out that, let me tell you, if you don't take it from me, the clear and definite information and knowledge, if you don't take it from me, that doesn't mean you're just going to sit there and do nothing. You're going to act anyway, but you'll be acting under illusion. So Krishna tells him, think about what I said and do what you want, but at the same time, bear in mind the consequences of doing what you like. It's not that you're just going to sit there and be neutral. Impossible. So can everybody kind of grasp that with the way we live our life, we are committing ourselves? We're implicated? Everyone can accept that point? That means there's reactions to your actions. It's not like the world is just waiting. Well, there won't be any reactions for you until you figure out what you're doing. It doesn't work like that. Now, there are reactions to the activity of matter. In school, they'll teach you that. Chemicals have reactions. If you push something, there's a reaction. If you move something, there's a reaction. But Bhagavad Gita is teaching you that besides all that, there are reactions to how you use your consciousness. And that the most intelligent person is always thinking of those things. What are the reactions to my consciousness? That is the most essential part of us. Am I this body or am I something else? Because you have consciousness, you realize you're something else. Now, what is that something else? To understand all that, the best way is to hear from the Supreme Consciousness, and that's what Bhagavad Gita is based on, giving you a chance to hear from the Supreme Consciousness. So you'd think that everybody would be fascinated with that, wouldn't you? Or maybe. What would you say? But we don't see everybody pouring over Bhagavad Gita. So why is that? All right, we're just going to look at some verses in the 18th chapter. Those of you who were here last week, you know we discussed the modes of material nature. We're going to discuss knowledge in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Let's turn to page 811. Now, as we discussed last week, everything in material existence is described in Bhagavad Gita as coming in three flavors: goodness, passion, and ignorance. And we read all about the different flavors, and last week we saw that 99.9% of the people today are in passion and ignorance. Who was here last week besides Grant? Anyone else? Yes, you remember that? You remember how we all thought we might be in goodness, but then we heard what goodness is like and we realized this is a very high qualification. I think you were the ones who thought that you were one of the ones who thought that automatically you kind of be in goodness, right? Okay, so we're going to discuss knowledge in goodness, passion, and ignorance, because Bhagavad Gita teaches you that all aspects of your life are flavors of these modes, these infections. You either get an infection of goodness, passion, or ignorance, but you are infected, because as you make your way through life, you pick up contaminations. It's not that you're just going here and there and everything is neutral and cool. No, you're taking on germs. Nature is doing like that. Bhagavad Gita will teach you what nature actually is. Nature is it's full of different winds or currents. And so as you make your way through nature, you're affected by all these different currents. Just like what kind of wind has been blowing the past week? Yeah, so everything is cold. Similarly, you have goodness, passion, and ignorance, and they affect all the relationships between matter and consciousness in the universe. So, you might say, well, how do you know whether my knowledge is in goodness, passion, or ignorance? You'd be shocked to see how it's quite easy to see. Now let's read about knowledge in the mode of goodness. Text 20 on page 811. Sarva-bhuteshu yenakam bhavam avyayam ikshate avibhaktam vibhakteshu tajjnanam virisatvikam. Would you like to read the translation? Okay.
The
Now bear in mind, this goodness doesn't mean perfection. The mode of goodness means the most elevated condition you can get in the material world, but it's still binding. You're still conditioned. You're not on the spiritual platform. But the mode of goodness is very important because it's the first stepping stone to the transcendental platform. You can't see anything straight, the Vedas describe, until you at least come to the mode of goodness. When you're in passionate ignorance, you can't understand anything. And, as we discussed last week, 99.9% of society today is saturated with passionate ignorance. Therefore, even when people talk about so-called spiritual things, they have no idea what they're talking about, because it's passion and ignorance. Now let's read an explanation of what the mode of goodness knowledge is, what is it actually like? Can you read the first one?
Whatever is the one spirit soul, if you living being, whether a demigod, human being, animal, bird, beast, or other, or plant, the best knowledge of one goodness. In all of the entities, one spirit soul is there, although they have different bodies in terms of their previous spirit. That's described in the 7th chapter. The manifestation of the living force in everybody is due to the superior nature of the Supreme Lord. Thus to see that one superior nature and thus that living force in everybody is exceeded in the mind of goodness. That living energy is imperishable, although the bodies are perishable. Differences are perceived in terms of the body because there are many forms of material existence in conditional life. Differences are perceived in terms of the body. Because there are many forms of material existence in conditional life, the living force appears to be divided. Such impersonal mind is an aspect of self-realization.
Any questions about this? You understand that? Motive goodness knowledge means you understand there's a spiritual energy which causes light. You're not completely clear what that spiritual energy exactly is, but you're certain that there's a spiritual energy behind all the different forms of bodies. And that knowledge has practical effects. It's not that you just go around in a vague way and say, yeah, everybody is spiritual, the energy, I know there's a spiritual energy. Meanwhile, you know, you're gobbling up the bodies of other living entities. If you actually understand that there's a spiritual force present in everyone, then you change the way you treat all living entities. Now, according to Vedic culture, every creature in the land is considered a citizen, not just a human being. Now, how would that affect the economy of New Zealand? If we considered every living creature as a citizen with the right to be protected. Does that sound unnatural to anyone? To consider all living entities, the sheep, the cows, everything, all of them as citizens? So, according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, the government does not just protect human beings. Of course, these days, if you can get the government to protect human beings, it's pretty good. But according to the Vedic culture, the government protects all creatures. That is motive goodness knowledge, because all the bodies are different dresses. Present in each body is the spiritual energy. This is motive goodness knowledge. And it means you actually change the way you're acting. It's not that you just go on in the same way, doing the same things, but meanwhile you're saying, yeah, it's all spiritual. Yes, spirituality, image of that. In other words, in the Vedic standard, according to the Vedic standard, there's very little credit given to theoretical knowledge. Your knowledge has to be evidenced in action. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about the fire of transcendental knowledge that burns. There's nothing theoretical about fire. Similarly, there's nothing theoretical about knowledge in the full sense. It has to be evidenced in what you do. That's the difference you have to bear in mind. A difference you have to bear in mind when reading Bhagavad Gita and giving it the term knowledge as contrasted with the way Western civilization deals with the concept of knowledge. You've got to show the evidence of your spiritual knowledge in your life. Now, one last point in this sentence, you'll notice that it's called impersonal knowledge because you're not quite clear what the source of this spiritual energy is, and you're not quite clear whether it's the same spiritual energy in every body, or you're just not clear. You haven't made up your mind completely about it, but you know for sure there's a spiritual energy and you've adjusted your lifestyle accordingly. That means you know you're not the body. Therefore, you don't pursue sense gratification. You don't try to please yourself by pleasing the body because you know you're not it. Now, that is a big change in lifestyle, isn't it? It's one thing to say, yeah, I'm spiritual. Yeah, I believe in reincarnation, all that. Yeah, you just go on and on. That's one thing. But to actually understand you're not the body so that you stop trying to please yourself through the body, that's another level, and that's what's being talked about here, motive goodness. This is the minimum requirement. Short of this, there's nothing clear. There's just murky, you know, lost bewilderment. So, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is presenting the motive goodness as a minimum qualification. Now, actually, the purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to take you beyond. Because even the mode of goodness is a material infection that binds. You'll take another birth, even as a result of the mode of goodness. You'll get a very good birth, but still it'll be another birth. So let's, once again, just like last week, let's keep in mind how exalted, comparatively today, the mode of goodness is. You have definite spiritual understanding, I'm not this body. As definite as you have the understanding that you're not the shirt on your back. It's not anything vague. None of you are vague about the clothes you wear. You don't identify with the clothes. You don't. The clothes are just something external I put on. But we are not situated in mode of goodness knowledge until we're that clear about our body and our spiritual identity. At least we have to understand there's a spiritual energy for sure. And that understanding is shown in that we live a life free from trying to please ourselves with the body. Now what does that say for society today? Everyone's reading a lot of spiritual books. But do we see anybody changing their lifestyle to show that they think they're not the body? Do we see that? When you talk about the higher power, that is a mode of goodness notion. But there's a difference. Because the activities may not evidence that there is a spiritual energy, therefore it's not the mode of goodness. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, it's good to recognize that there's a higher power. But what is that power? What you're actually talking about is that there's a spiritual energy beyond the body. That means we're not the body, we are that spiritual energy. But until we change our life so that we stop trying to act like we're the body, then it's not the mode of goodness. It's just a notion we have. Mode of goodness knowledge is born out in action. You understand, there's matter and there's spirit. Since I'm spirit, I don't indulge as if I'm matter. You understand it? Now that requires a firm program of activity. This is not just, you know, some kind of, you know, la-di-da. this is the essence, this is the action. Yeah. Therefore, I was asking you, what do you do during your day? Because that shows you where your conceptions are. All right, let's read about the mode of passion. Knowledge in the mode of passion. I lost 8 on that. page 12. Okay, let's turn to page 12. We'll get on more familiar ground now once we head into passionate ignorance. I'll read the Sanskrit text 21. Prasaktvena tiyajgyanam nana bhavan prasakvidan veti sarveshu bhuteshu tajgyanam vidhi rajasam. Who'd like to read? Okay, here it comes.
That knowledge follows one sees that in every different body there is a different type of living entity you should understand to be in meditation.
Sounds more familiar, doesn't it? That's what that say. What that means is when you see a different type of living entity in a different body, it means in every different body, it means you are the body. You have a different body, therefore you're a different person. You're identifying each person as the body. That's mode of passion. Would you like to read the first?
And that with the destruction of the body, the consciousness is also destroyed. It's called knowledge in a mode of passion. According to that knowledge, bodies differ from one another because of the development of different types of consciousness. Otherwise, there is no separate soul which manifests consciousness. The body is itself the soul, and there is no separate soul beyond the body. According to such knowledge, consciousness is temporary. For us, there are no individual souls, but there is an all-pervading soul, which is full of knowledge, and this body is a manifestation of temporary ignorance. For beyond this body, there is no special individual or supreme soul. All such conceptions are considered products of the mode of passion.
Yes, these are all different theories indicative of the mode of passion. You think, I am the body, you think, the body is the soul, or consciousness is temporary, or we all are the all-pervading soul. All this is mode of passion concoction. Now that's generally what you're going to hear today. Now you see there's a subtle difference I'll just mention briefly for you. Those of you who are into subtle understandings. You notice the mode of goodness says that it's impersonal knowledge. You perceive that there's a spiritual energy beyond the body. Now you notice in the mode of passion here that you realize that there's an all-pervading soul. Now, there's a difference. The mode of goodness, you recognize that there's an all-pervading spiritual energy, but you don't just say, there's no individuality, we're all just that one pervading energy. But in the mode of passion, you have no experience of that, but you say it anyway. Mode of goodness is open. I know there's an all-pervading spiritual energy. I don't know whether it is personal or impersonal, but I know I'm not the body. There's a spiritual force that's me. That's mode of goodness. Mode of passion, you don't know, but you just say things. We're all one. It is all I. I am you. You are me. We're all God. This is mode of passion. Just crazy things you say. You heard people talk like that before? Any questions about this?
Ultimately, everyone was in the mode of goodness from animals.
Yes. Why not? They'd probably have a better life, because if everyone was in the mode of goodness, they wouldn't get eaten. I didn't touch on that today, but the point is, if everyone today is in the mode of goodness, then the animals will not be slaughtered. There's still going to be animals, though, because souls are taking animal bodies. Regardless of how the human beings right now are acting. You see the point? Any other questions? Okay. We'll continue on familiar ground. Mode of ignorance. Text 22, page 813. Yatu Krishna Vare Kasmin Kaye Saktam Ahaitukam Asatvata Vrapuncha Satamasam Udahitam. Who's going to read? Would you like to read? Do you have a book? Yeah, text 22.
The translation?
Yeah, I left that first.
And that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of word is all in all, without knowledge of the truth, and which is very meager, except it in the mode of darkness.
Yes, that's actually like what's on this board here, the mode of darkness. Because after all is said and done, what does everybody do? That's what you gotta watch for after they say this kind of stuff. They don't care if I'm answering their only discussions and thoughts and silence, one day filling each one. What do they do? That shows you what they really think. And it generally is this, and the mode of ignorance. So you can read that real quick.
The knowledge of the common man is always in the mode of darkness or the because every living entity is in conditional life. Inconditional life conforming to the mode of ignorance. If one does not develop knowledge through the authorities or scriptural injunctions or knowledge that the goodness of the body, he is not concerned about acting in tune with the directions of scripture.
In other words, he says there's no standard, there's no set of instructions that comes with the universe, just whatever you think is right, that's what you do.
For God is money.
For him.
For him, God is money. And knowledge means the satisfaction of what is done.
Yes. You notice when it comes to sense gratification, people are very precise. You tell them there's a good book that describes how to have better sense gratification. Everybody wants to read it. The men are from Mars, women are from Venus, this, that, the other. Yeah. Oh, definite knowledge. You want to get real specific then. When it comes to spiritual things, oh, it's all vague, it's all formless, it's all whatever. But when it comes to, you know, which movie will you go to tonight? Oh, you're very specific. Which movie will you go see? So in this way, by our actions, you see where we're really at. You actually see where our knowledge really is at. It's either passion at the most or ignorance.
Such knowledge has no connection with the essence of truth. It is more or less like the knowledge of the ordinary animal. The knowledge of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. Such knowledge is described here as the product of mode of darkness. In other words, knowledge concerning the spirit soul beyond this body is called knowledge of the mode of goodness. Knowledge producing theories and doctrines by hint of mundane objects and into speculation is the product of just mode of passion. And knowledge concerned only with keeping the body comfortable is into the mode of goodness.
Okay. So, where does everybody think things are at now? Goodness, passion, or ignorance? Yeah. What do you say?
You are saying general for ignorance.
Anyone think that there's goodness? Please, you please describe it. Okay, but can you please describe it? Besides here, that is, here's an invention. It's actually not the mode of goodness here, it's beyond the mode of goodness. That's something else. But anyway. Yeah, here is special, so when you're studying Bhagavad Gita, it's not, you're not under the influence of the mode of, even the mode of goodness, it's, you're beyond that. But give me some other instances.
see some of the light, like fragrance.
So, in terms of knowledge, how would that affect your knowledge? These modes are very specific. That's why Krishna is speaking like this. Just to, you know, it cuts down your room to maneuver, doesn't it? That's, you know, the modes in Sanskrit, they're called gunas. Guna means rope, cords that bind. So as soon as you understand that in all your thoughts, your work, your determination, the food you eat, your conceptions, they're all products of these gunas or ropes, then you really see what's going on. So it's not like, you know, there's some nebulousness. It's either this or it's that. Just like on a highway, you're either driving in this lane or that lane. So please, you give an example of how there is mode of goodness and knowledge. I know what happens. See, most people, they start thinking about this word goodness, irrespective of particular symptoms. You know what I mean? So you just hear the word goodness, you start thinking, yeah, there's some goodness in this world. But when you hear the standard given in Bhagavad Gita, it really helps to ground us, you know? You know what I mean? Anyone else can see some goodness?
Those people that stand Christian Children's Fellowship meant to think people that come to make a difference, positive difference in the world, those who call their people.
What does that mean, make a positive difference? I mean, those are good words, but what is that? The handles you're getting in Bhagavad Gita, turning the handle, that positive difference, what's that mean? You have a better self-esteem? You think better of yourself?
Rather than acting selfishly, you're selfishly for the good of other people. Good attitude is a chance.
A chance to do what?
A chance to have the same opportunity as everyone else.
What is that opportunity? Any creature has an opportunity to live, at least before you kill them and eat them, but you know, any creature has an opportunity to live. Okay, alright. Fair enough. But after they get the food and medical resources, then what do? Hey, you're pretty smart. So what's changed, really? From your point of view, you might say that you helped them live a bit longer, but nothing else has changed, has it? Because if you're actually in the mode of goodness, you know that the soul cannot be killed, so their existence is eternal anyway. But the problem is, because we think we're the body, we have no experience of our spiritual identity. Even though we may talk spiritual, the soul, eternal, this, that, we actually have that experience. Because we lack the experience and the knowledge, we go on doing the same as everybody else. Suppose you were hungry, and I said, oh, I'm going to make a positive difference, positive change. I'm going to give you the same opportunity that I have. I'm going to treat you to a wonderful steak dinner. And what about the cow? You see? So where's the mode of goodness? Why would you be happy? Full of what? What kind of food? Describe it.
No,
describe it. Your stomach is full of what? is what? Be more specific. It's flesh of a dead body. So you're happy because your stomach is full. It's just a dead body. You wash it down with some beer, right, or some wine, right? Full of flesh. Pieces of corpses in there. Medium rare. Well done, rare. And that makes you happy, right? Because you can feel this. Belly's really poking out, you know. It's got onions on it, make it real pungent and spicy, right? And you're very thankful, Paul. Thank you so much. You thank the cow, too? I know you're a happy cow for giving yourself in this way. Sometimes you go to butcher shops and you see and they have a sign out with a happy cow's face. You ever think like that when you... So would I be doing you good to do that to you? Huh? Now from the Vedic standpoint, I would be responsible for implicating you in bad karma. I would get a karmic reaction as well as you. Both you and I would be guilty. Just like, you know, on the street, if the police catch me giving you some drugs, you take the drugs, but I gave it to you, we'll both be liable for criminal charges. We're both implicated. And then what will the police try to find out? Where did I get the drugs from before I gave them to you? And then they'll try to find out how the drugs were manufactured or who brought them into the country. And this way the police will look for the hole, ideally. They're probably taking it themselves, but ideally, they'll look for the whole network. So that's the way the law of karma works. Everybody involved gets a karmic reaction. But you thought it's good. This is really good, this. My belly's full of those pieces of flesh, medium rare. If you teach the science of Bhagavad Gita, then you are beyond the mode of goodness. And the one who studies Bhagavad Gita is also beyond the mode of goodness. That's a special thing. Mode of goodness is impersonal spiritual knowledge. Bhagavad Gita is beyond that. You learn that beyond your impersonal conception, everything is simply personal. Just like a person can be impersonal. If you want to, you can treat somebody impersonally. So similarly, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that he has an impersonal spiritual appearance, which is supposed to go beyond. So when people talk about higher force or higher power, that's impersonal. Just like suppose I'm looking at you and I just, you know, there's a power there. Josh, you came from a power. There's a higher power. Now, how would you feel about that? I mean, you... Yeah, you say, hey, wait a minute, I'm a person, I'm me, I'm an individual. No, you're a higher power. May the power be with you. How would you feel? I know you can't talk because you're just a higher power. How would you feel about that? Yeah, okay. So Krishna says the same thing in Bhagavad Gita. He's offended. In other words, you have personal things about you. And I should get to know that if I'm going to talk about you. I should just brush you off. It's a higher power over there. See that behind Josh? It's a higher power. You see the point?
Yeah. I mean, give me my... Are you talking personally about my description of what I said before?
No, I'm just, you know, we're just talking. Any questions? You've been pretty quiet all the way back there. Now, if we were going to consider making a change, what would we do? Hearing what you heard about the ignorance, passion, and goodness, if we were going to consider making a change, what would we do? Any suggestions? What kind of knowledge would we try to develop? Who you are, what your program is. What kind of knowledge do you feel your life is involved with? This is why it's good for us to do this. Using what we just discussed about passion, ignorance, goodness, what kind of knowledge you think your life's involved in. Otherwise, you can really start tripping out, you know, relationships and the higher powers and the this and the that. And just using the model of goodness, passion, ignorance. Take a stab and we'll help you. Why would you choose ignorance? Well, that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work as all in all, it means, you know, it's my job is every day, I just gotta get the money, I'm just trying to pay the rent, just put some food on the table. Have some good pleasures, hey, don't bug me about anything more. Mode of ignorance. Therefore, the purport says, the quote-unquote knowledge of the common man is always in the mode of ignorance or darkness because every living and any conditional life is born in the mode of ignorance. You don't develop any particular knowledge through standard spiritual texts. You're just concerned about money and satisfying the bodily demands. Does that sound too severe? Now, how do you fit the relationships into that? You mentioned the word relationships. I know it's a very hallowed word these days. Relationships. Now, what actually happens in those relationships? We just talked about his steak dinner now. we'll get specific with you. What happens in the relationships? Yes. And generally, what kind of actions and reactions? Be specific. Give an example of a relationship.
Relationship
with food. Okay. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, food is described in three categories, goodness, passion, or ignorance. Now, food in the mode of ignorance, that is decaying flesh. Food in the mode of passion is very spicy vegetarian food, very hot, lots of chili and onions and that kind of stuff, but it's vegetarian. And food in the mode of goodness is naturally sweet, very healthy, very nourishing for the body and the mind. So the relationship with food, that's also the three modes. You see, the three modes cover everything. It keeps us from, kidding ourselves. That's why it's a good thing to read. Even charity is in three modes: goodness, passion, ignorance. To give someone meat, thinking you're helping to feed them, and it's good charity. That's known as charity in the mode of ignorance. You have no idea what you're doing. It's just like if I give you poison to drink because you're thirsty, without knowing it. So it's not that you can just give... You see, according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, you can't do anything without precise knowledge. We don't like that, do we? In life you should be able to kind of just, things should be vague, so you can have lots of room to, space out, and make your own blend, and make your own reactions too, make your own system, in other words, be God. That's why it's good for us to study these three modes, because we see how everything is prescribed. We don't like that, though. And that's another symptom of the mode of ignorance, that we refuse to accept that there's an ultimate standard. Suppose when you were raising Josh, he's 5 years old, and you tell him that he can't run out into the street in the middle of traffic. And suppose he tells you, "Oh, Dad, this is no clear and final answer." This is the wonder of each moment. When I'm running in between the cars, I really feel that wonder. What would you say? Huh? No. What would you say? You probably would. Anyway, what would you say? Oppose? I thought there's no clear and final answer. Oppose a thought impulse. Why? Oh, you see? Things really get definite real quick now. And what gives you the right to impose your authority upon him? But that shouldn't be, it shouldn't be that way?
Oh, that's karma. I didn't mind any different.
So if you had a 5-year-old kid now, you'd let the kid do whatever he or she wanted to do? What would you do? You still impose your authority. Why? So ultimately, when it comes down to it, we do recognize there has to be a standard. But as long as we make the standard, it's okay. As soon as the standard comes from somewhere else, it's dogma, it's restrictive, it's... But if we make the laws, they're quite all right, and quite good.
Well, there are plenty of other instances of what's being made. It's a matter of ownership of these things. Some of these things you can take up ownership on them.
And can you give me an example?
Well, you go down the road, you go up and you get into a discussion with somebody, an argument develops, before you know it, you think it's way beyond the point where you can't control yourself. And you're hopeless, and then you walk away from it. Later on, it's only later on that you begin to disown your heart, and that you feel like you shouldn't have done this. But it wasn't wrong to me.
Now, you may make that mental adjustment, but does that mean you've actually tidied up all the reactions to the situation?
Suppose you've taken ownership of the situation, then you're prepared to accept the consequences.
Now, who decides? How do you get it? Oh, let me put it this way. How do you get an overall view of what all the consequences are? And how do you, just in the world as you see it, how do you get a handle on all the consequences? Just like if you decided to feed this hungry young man here and you gave him a steak dinner, that'd be alright to you? Oh, what about the cow? You see? No, 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 no. Oh, so it's, okay, so in, let's say, there's a, you know, we'll kill a person and then decide what to do with the person's property, and because the person's already dead, it's like, you know, it's out of the question, the person's out of the question.
No.
So my point is, how do you get a grip on what all the consequences are? Even in the small area of your life, or the small area of my life.
Well, I
just gave you an example. If you give him a stake, isn't that an immediate consequence affecting you? You've just taken part in the web of animal slaughter.
Yeah, if I believe that it's wrong, if I don't believe it's wrong, I don't see that I have to take part in a crime because I have not, in my own beliefs transgressed.
Oh, so if I come to your house and burn it down, it's all right because I haven't accepted that in my mind as a crime. How would you feel? No, but I haven't accepted it as a crime, so therefore, you know. But in mine, it isn't. And I'm dealing with my consequences.
So I'm saying, and the person who I'm giving the stake to, if they feel it's a crime, then I wouldn't do it. But if they did not feel it was a crime, then, and they wanted to do it, then they are quite welcome to do it.
So, if somebody thought that, you know, you giving them drugs was not a crime, and you did it.
If I was participating in that culture.
No. Then would that be a good excuse for the police? That he didn't think it was a crime, so I gave him the drug?
The doctor's really good, eh?
Now, who decides the right and wrong? This is where you differentiate between knowledge and passion, ignorance and goodness. Who lays down the standard?
The standard is laid down by the Supreme.
And what is that Supreme?
Whatever. So you take your stance and what you think, or feel, or whatever, is the right thing to do at that given moment. And if you do not do the right thing to do, you'll know inside that you have done wrong.
How do you know inside? Do you get a sour feeling in your stomach? So I'll give you the same example. I'm just using it as an example. So when you bite into a steak, do you get that sour feeling in your belly? Why not?
Because I don't feel that I am touching someone's life unnecessary or eating flesh in any form.
Alright. So, okay, my point though is, it probably is very highly inaccurate to just go by our feelings like that. It seems that if, as you say, now I didn't say it, you said, that there's some kind of supreme or whatever, we've got to really get some definite knowledge, otherwise we could be just really stumbling in the darkness, you know? So that seems to be the where we should be heading. Let's get some specific knowledge of this supreme whatever. Because as you say, the law is actually laid down by the supreme whatever. So we better get some specific knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So therefore you see that these modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, they're very specific. As things are in every case very specific. Any final questions? Now what to do? What to do?
Well, you're going to tell us how to take on the front of this elevated consciousness.
I'll leave that to your mate here. Yeah? No further questions. And you, Mr. Relationship, what will you do?
How important is it to have a spiritual master in your life?
Well, let's look at it this way. When you want to learn something, isn't it the quickest way to find someone who knows and learn from them? That's true even when it comes to fixing your car. You have a computer, well, you know that it always pays to have a friend who knows about computers, right? Or maybe you're the one who knows a lot and all your friends call you up. Is that the way it is? Yeah, but you have a friend who, it doesn't work. So you're recognizing that there's an authority that can solve things quicker than you, right? Now, if that's so in terms of ordinary mundane things, how much more is true in terms of inconceivable transcendental things? When it comes to knowledge beyond the range of your senses and mind, the only way you can get information is through hearing from an authorized source. If you want to understand New York, let's say, I would take it you haven't been to New York. So, the best way to learn, because it's inconceivable to you, you haven't been there, is the best way to learn is to hear from somebody who knows about it. Similarly, to get knowledge of what lies beyond your senses, the best way is to learn from someone who has that knowledge. And why do they have that knowledge? Because they heard from somebody who has that knowledge. And ultimately, you can trace it back to the Supreme. You can trace it back to Krishna. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you actually want to know how things work, you find a genuine spiritual teacher. And what is the symptom of a genuine spiritual teacher? The genuine spiritual teacher simply says what Krishna says. A good postman. Posting. Delivers the post without changing. Now you may say, what's the big deal about that? It is a very big deal. To be able just to deliver the post and not change anything. Because, as you might sense tonight, because we have our program, our individual programs of sense desires and whatever, we're always molding our so-called metaphysical statements accordingly. You notice that? So it's not easy just to say what the ultimate standard says. To do that, you have to have great mind and sense control. Especially we all like to speculate. Well, I think it's like this, I think it's like that, and it takes great humility to simply take knowledge as it's handed down from the Supreme and give that to others without ruining it with your own speculations. So the Vedas say if you're actually serious about transcendental knowledge, then you approach a spiritual master. The spiritual master doesn't think he or she is so great. They think simply that they're doing a job passing the post on. The way the Vedic system works is today's student becomes tomorrow's teacher. So it's not like an ego trip, you know. It's just practical. Maybe you remember when you were in college how There were some students in the front of the classroom who were always hanging on to the teacher's every word. Yeah. And then there were some students in the back of the classroom who were just, you know, yeah. Just, being making mischief and just ignoring the whole lesson. So, what did you call the students who were right in the front of the classroom hanging on to the teacher's every word? What did you call them? Don't you call it a teacher's pet?
Yeah, right.
But you notice the teacher was always very enthused by these students, right?
Yeah.
And now you can understand that any teacher is always enthused by students who want to learn. And then you understand that those students who were in the front of the classroom, if they were genuinely wanting to learn, they were picking up a lot because the teacher was obviously wanting to give. Whereas the guys in the back of the classroom, they're So therefore, the whole Vedic system of submissively approaching as genuine spiritual teacher is very important. Okay. Everyone ready for dinner? So I hope you all will seriously study Bhagavad Gita. If you're having difficulty, you think it's too big, it isn't. But if you, I've written a small appetizer for Bhagavad Gita. You'll find it quite nice. But, certainly, you all have good brains, and you're deserving of Bhagavad Gita. All right, thank you very much.
Subject matter will be Krishna. So yesterday we were reading about Krishna entering Mathura. He and Balaram, you power boys, were causing a bit of a ruckus in the capital city of Kansas. They're basically cruising through the town. Whole society is organized around hearing about Krishna, not simply individualized. There's no way a government can diminish the anxieties of the people without an organized program for hearing.